My curiosity and love for scripture has been reignited after engaging with the poems. And what people often tell me is that the poems have given them permission to engage the text in a different way.
Hey, it's Scott, and welcome to Theology Lab. I loved listening to Drew Jackson talk about the Bible and how he takes on questions that come up in his life as a Christian. Drew's a co-host of the popular Everything Belongs podcast with Richard Rohr. It's a podcast that engages Rohr's teachings. If you love poetry, I imagine this episode will be a gift to you. Drew even reads some of his poems, which are reflections on the Gospel of Luke. I am not someone who has much, if any, real background in poetry. But talking with Drew and getting into his work offered up so much. As a Christian, I want to read scripture and think about how it connects to my world today. Drew's poetry, his reflections on his work and his readings have a way of doing that almost seamlessly. It's hard not to listen to Drew and his work and to start imagining what we might hope the God of the Bible could do in our world today. Honestly, it gets me to pray. There's a link to two of Drew's books on his poetry in the show notes to this episode. If you enjoy the Theology Lab podcast, you can always help us out by subscribing to it or sharing it with a friend who might like it as well. Here's my conversation with Drew Jackson. Drew, you say that we need poetry in our time. You say this right at the beginning of God Speaks Through Rooms. Why is this? Why do Christians need poetic interaction with the Bible, particularly at a time like this?
I think poetry is something that I would say all of us need it, whether we identify as Christian or not, that there's something about the invitation that poetry gives us into mystery, into curiosity, that, in a time where where a lot of us are coming up against the limitations of the answers that we've been given to how the world works. Or when I think about it inside of the church context, we've come up to against the limits of some of the pat answers maybe we've been given in Sunday school about our views of God and what it means to be human in the world. And so we're asking a lot of questions, and a lot of times when we come up against the limits of the answers we've been given, we can either retreat back into those easy answers and say, you know what, it's a I just need an answer to hold on to. But I think what poetry does is it invites us deeper into the questions, into the mystery of it. And I think there's, maybe we'll talk about this a little later on, but I think there's a reason that so much of scripture is filled with poetry. And from the Psalms to the prophetic text to even the ways that Jesus talks about or delivers his parables, there's a lot of, poetic devices in those. And I think that one of the things that does is it invites us more deeply into the questions of what it means to be human, what it means to love, what it means to be in love with God, with one another, with this world that we're in. And transformation more often happens in the context of wrestling with questions than it does being given easy answers. And so when I think about poetry in our time, I really think it's an invitation into the questions, into the mystery, as a part of our transformation, both individually and collectively, together. And I was reading an article that came out not too long ago. It was simply asking the questions, have we re-entered a golden age of poetry? And that there's been this really a resurgence of people wanting to engage poetry. And I think part of the reason is what I was just talking about. Like, so many of us are really wrestling with these big cosmic questions that don't have easy answers. And poetry says, bring your questions here. They don't need to be resolved, but you can sit with them and see where they take you.
Drew, that's a super intriguing response. I think there's a lot of folks. There are probably a lot of folks in this call, a lot of folks that will be listening to this or watching this, who are at a place in their faith where they're asking big questions. Like, as you said, you know, they've heard certain answers that just don't seem to work that the way they used to. And if poetry can offer us a way into those, especially where change can happen and like the challenge of that and sometimes maybe the insecurities of that as well, that's really enticing. We are going to kind of go back and forth with questions tonight. I'm going to ask you kind of general questions about poetry, faith, and reading scripture. And then in between those, get a chance to hear you read poetry. So I'm going to ask if you would to read us the poem. I believe it's called Views. This is based on Luke chapter 4, verses 5 to 8 and the temptation of Jesus. Could you read this? Tell us just what animates you in reading this poem. And I would love to hear just a little bit about what the process is like for you going from reading scripture to crafting and expressing a poem in this contemporary context like you do.
Absolutely. So I'll say a little bit about just the concept of the books, both books in general, of these are books that are in conversation with the Gospel of Luke. So all of the poetry is in conversation with different verses within the gospel. And it's not meant to be a commentary, but it is trying to bring all of myself and the current context in which we live into conversation with the text. And so this particular poem, as you've mentioned, is in conversation with the temptations. Jesus is in the desert, and Satan comes to him and offers him these three temptations. And so this poem is called Views, and it's a what we would call a persona poem. So what you'll hear is I'm writing the poem from the perspective of both Jesus and Satan, the accuser, in conversation, and they're kind of going back and forth. So this poem is called Views. The view from up here is beautiful. There's nothing like a penthouse with a private rooftop deck to look out on all you have conquered. I mean, to look out at the city. This unobstructed view, you can see from sea to shining sea, from the East River to the Hudson. It makes me want more, and you can have it. Imagine the development you could do. We've already flattened Manhattan, gave it a better sounding name, and cleared out Seneca for our premier park. Let the horizon be your motivation. You only have to invest the small sum of your soul and your people. You're selling this thing real good, but I'll pass. That price is too high for my liking. So in this poem, there's a lot happening. I was thinking about in the biblical text where, Satan brings Jesus up onto a high mountain and shows him all of the kingdoms of the world. And is saying, you can have all of this if you will just, bow to me, right? If you can have it all. And so what I'm doing in this poem is really setting that in this context of, living in New York, this is very, very, the imagery of New York is here. So it's as if Jesus is being brought up onto the top of a, penthouse looking out over Manhattan. And it's almost as if Satan is this sort of real estate agent making this, trying to sell the city to Jesus and saying, you can have all of this. You can have it all. And what's happening though is there's some subtle things in here where it's really hinting at the cost of what having it all means. And the sort of taking on the what you do with power in order to get what's yours, you conquer whatever's in your way. And so this imagery of having conquered Manhattan, which was once indigenous land called Manhattan, that means hilly land. And so I'd say, you know, we've already flattened Manhattan, gave it a better sounding name, and cleared out Seneca for our premier park, which is a reference to Seneca Village, which was a African-American community that was located where Central Park is, that was completely demolished and flattened in order to make room for this park, you know. And so it's really just kind of getting at what it means to sell your soul and to sell out your neighbors, to sell out your people in order to get power, to take hold of this temptation that's being offered to you. So the poem kind of, you get inside of that, and I don't know what kind of comes up for you when you hear that, but it was really me just trying to bring that exchange and that temptation into my modern context, and put myself inside of the narrative.
I love that. There is a follow-up question I want to ask you about what this means for engaging the Bible, but I'm going to hold off until you've either read your second or third poem a little later on.
Yeah.
Let me go to this question here. You know, right at the beginning of God Speaks Through Wombs, that you write unapologetically as a Black man. I'm wondering if in writing these books, you could tell us, what does it mean to write for those who share that identity and for those who don't? Like, what do you want different audiences? What do you hope different audiences will get out of your poetry?
Yeah. Well, when I first started writing this book, it wasn't actually, I didn't approach it as I'm trying to write a book. It started for me as a spiritual practice. And both the reading of poetry and the writing of poetry are very much spiritual practice for me. And I started writing this book at the beginning of 2020 as everything in the world was changing, right? We go into lockdown. I'm in this tiny New York City apartment with my family, 5-year-old twin girls at the time, you know, and yeah, it was like all of that was happening with the pandemic, but then it was also just this, everything that was going on in terms of what people are calling the racial reckoning of our of 2020, right? And just the murders of Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and all of the conversations that were swirling around those things. And you know, I found myself in so many spaces where, you know, as we're having these conversations, I found people like, and I would share my own experience and my own story of just navigating this world, navigating the landscape of America in this body, and some of the things I've come up against. And I've had, you know, I had people really kind of question the legitimacy of this, of what I was saying, right? My own narrative. Am I making this up? Am I right? And so part of my coming to poetry in particular, and the coming in conversation with the Gospel of Luke, was I found myself needing to be in conversation with some people who I didn't have to convince myself to, and who could resonate with where I was coming from. And Luke, in his gospel, is interested. One of the things he's interested in is centering the voices of those who are on the margins and the narrative of this narrative of the gospel that he's telling. And so the centering the voices of the poor, centering the voices of women, in his articulation of this gospel narrative. And so I was like, you know, there's something about Luke's gospel that I feel like I can be in conversation with the characters in the story who know what it means to kind of experience the underside of empire, to live kind of on that side of things, and to have to navigate and wrestle with the questions. And so that's really one of the places that this rose from. And I felt like, you know, growing up in the church context that I grew up in, was pretty, you know, conservative fundamentalist Baptist church, independent fundamental Baptist church, where you really bringing your full self to your reading of an interpretation of text was not encouraged. So it was really, you were really told there is a plain reading of the text. And so you have to, you know, put to the side any of your own kind of things that you would bring to it and just come to the plain reading of the text. And, you know, I just, through my years of, you know, studying scripture, studying theology, have just come to this place of saying there isn't really no such thing as a plain reading of the text, that every time we come to the text, no matter who we are, we come with our lenses, we come with our experiences, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, but I think it's a thing that we need to acknowledge, and part of the journey is to become conscious of the lenses that we bring to the text. And then part of the beauty of it is that we, when we can bring our full selves to the text and come into conversation with others, then we start to see, oh, there's a whole lot happening here that, you know, maybe I didn't see, you know, from my particular lens, because that's not my social location. That's not the way that, you know, the text is meeting me, but it's multivocal in that sense. There's so many things happening. And I think the one other thing I would say there is just that I always say that it's important to remember that the biblical text was not written by the Romans or those who were in power in the empire. It was written by those who were the marginalized of the empire. They were the outcast. They were the downtrodden. They were the poor. And so it changes the way that you hear the text when you hear it from those who are those, as Howard Thurman would say, those with their backs against the wall. So I'm bringing all of that, I think, as I'm engaging the text and as I'm writing these poems.
Okay, I want to stay with that for a second, if we can, about things that you hear in the text, as you approach it differently. I remember I also have kind of a conservative, fundamental-ish background, and I remember not feeling like it was okay to ask questions about largely like the historicity of things within the Old Testament. And certain events happened where that became necessary for me to do. And it felt like I was being able to bring actually a little bit more of my curiosities, myself, to the text. And then I started noticing these things, these interesting differences in the text, when I didn't have to just read it in just this quite kind of wooden, literal, straightforward, just historical kind of way. And it opened up scripture to me. I'm wondering if, you know, going on, digging a little deeper into what you said, if there are ways where, as you were able to get the sense of bringing more of yourself, of these gifts around poetry to scripture, not only was it freeing for you, but did you begin to see things differently within the text itself, new things within scripture?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one example of that is there's a poem that I wrote that's reflecting on Luke chapter 3, verse 20. And it is a very sort of Passover verse where it's kind of transitional in the narrative. Jesus finds out that his cousin John has been arrested, right? And there's not much that's said at that point. It's just kind of stated, this happens. As I was reading that, I got really sort of stuck there, and just brought into that space of Jesus, like what was going on in Jesus as he heard the news of his cousin being arrested by the governing authorities. And I started to really just begin to just connect with the humanity of Jesus in a different way as I was reading that. And just thinking about my own, just my own experience of the realities of something like mass incarceration that impacts disproportionately impacts the African American community. And I mean the numbers are staggering around that. In particular, you hear numbers like one out of every three black men between the ages of 18 and 35 are in the prison system, right? And it's like, I finally, it was like, I have a place where I can bring my tears about that. And I can experience a God who weeps with me in that. And not just a God who weeps with me from a, oh, that's bad. I'm sorry that that's happening. But a God who's like, I know what it's like to be there. I know what it's like to hear that news. I know what it's like for people to then put their own narratives on, what's happening with your people, what's going on, or it's like there's so I just so the text met me in a totally different way when I was able to bring sort of the fullness of myself in my experience into my reading there. And so there was a poem that emerged out of that called The Waters of My Weeping, where it was just, yeah, Jesus meeting me in the tears of weeping over the reality of what happens when empire unjustly incarcerates masses of people, and so so that's one example of that.
Drew, I feel like, and I told you this beforehand, when it comes to reading poetry, like I'm not even a beginner, but I so enjoyed reading these books because in some ways I feel like it's like looking at this piece of art and moving along with like someone else who just as you're also say reading scripture, and it's like you stop and you're pointing something out that like I would have just not only just passed by, that's an interesting feature of the text, but then you speak in a way about that feature that's like, wow, that is packed with meaning. It may not be my own experience of it, but I'm hearing God speak in a new way as you give voice to your own personal experiences in reading and insights into the biblical text. Let's go to the Luke 23 poem. So this is a poem on called The Daughters, The Way of the Cross, Via Crucis, The Daughters of Jerusalem, where you, I was just really struck when I read this poem because it's the daughters of Jerusalem who are following Jesus on the way to the cross. Jesus turns and addresses them, and in the poem, we'll hear you read it in a second, but you add voice to these people who are there at the cross. We don't hear what they say, but they're there. And your poem brings this to life in a really neat way. So if you could read this poem for us and maybe just tell us, like, I'd love to hear a little more about how you're thinking behind bringing out their voices and experiences and why they were there at the cross, why they stayed when others didn't.
So this poem, Via Crucis, Daughters of Jerusalem, it opens with an epigraph from a song by the Porter's Gate, Daughters of Zion. And it's a few lines where they say, "How long? How long? When will the daughters of Zion rejoice in the house of the Lord?" Surely they were there, drenching the road with tears. Surely years of suffering had formed them to run toward those in pain. How could they run away like their brothers? The sting of abandonment all too familiar to them. I have seen the image of Mamie Till wailing at her son's casket, her eyes pulled shut, her cheeks lifted up in agony. I have seen the image of Leslie McSpadden, tears dripping down her brown-skinned face. Her boy lay baking in the August sun, sprawled across that Ferguson street. You know, I think as I was writing this poem and just thinking about the mothers of those who have watched their sons lynched, and you know, use that term very purposely, you know, to talk about this act of intimidation, right? To say, you know, lynchings were always acts of public intimidation. And so when you think about what was happening at, you know, what a cross was used for, I mean, could reference James Cone's Across in the Lynching Tree, where he talks about this, but just this act of, you know, the governing authority saying, do not challenge us. Do not challenge Rome. This is what happens to those who go against our way, right? And so it was this public display of intimidation. And I think about something like the incident of the murder of Emmett Till, and the voice and the image of his mother wailing that really, you know, many say is the catalyst of the civil rights movement, that image of her wailing over her son's casket. And you know, I think part of what I was wanting to do here was both to, you know, give voice to Mamie Till and kind of bring her into the same lineage of the Daughters of Jerusalem and of Mary, who knew what it was like to wail as their sons were crucified, in a way, right? But I'm also giving, I'm saying something about Emmett Till, right? I'm saying something about this person, this black boy, fully made in the image of God, being murdered, being disregarded, being dehumanized, and saying, if we can't see Jesus reflected in the body of Emmett Till, if we can't see Jesus reflected in the body of Michael Brown laying on the Ferguson street for hours, right? Then we're missing something. We're not seeing something. If we can't hear the cries of Leslie McSpadden as she's weeping over her son's body, if that doesn't move us toward compassion and solidarity and saying something is deathly wrong here, right? Then something is not being moved within us. And so, I think all of those things for me were going on, and just bringing these realities into the same space of saying, we're not talking about two different things. We're not talking about two different things. And there's a reason that there's a phrase that James Cone used when he talks about the crucified peoples of the world, right? As a way of helping us see, you know, those who are being marginalized, oppressed, and brutalized at the hands of the state, often, to see them as we would see Christ on the cross. Like, how can we see through those eyes? So that's what was going on for me as I was writing this poem.
And hearing you describe that, I think I hope this is like your intended impact effect of this interpretation, this reading, is like seeing how my spirituality, if it's to mean something, it needs to mean something as I see the world happening around me and these acts of violence and this lack of justice. I might still see God present there, but maybe also calling me to something. But simply that these things are not the point, your point. These two things, like my what I'm reading in this text, my faith, my spirituality, and what's going on in the world right here, your poetry brings them together so well, so powerfully. I want to go to this question here. This is a more general question. How do you see your poetry helping you? I mean, it's building off of what we just talked about. Engaging with challenges, the challenges of navigating life. Maybe I'll put this in two different ways, and however you want to talk about it. Are there ways where, in terms of faith, like it helps you in dealing with particularly maybe challenging parts of the Bible? Or maybe are there ways where your poetry helps you in navigating simply like the ups and downs, the joys and challenges of life?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'll speak to both of those things. I think more generally speaking, poetry has been a medicine for me, in that it has been, I'm not generally I'm not a person that very easily is able to name what it is I'm feeling in a particular moment. Right. So if you ask me how you're doing, how you feeling, like it takes me a second to actually answer that honestly. And poetry has given me the space to be able to articulate what's going on in my own interior landscape, in a way that nothing else has, to really sort of explore what is going on in my interior world. How do I give voice to that? How do I name that? Particularly, the anger, the sadness that is often underneath of the anger, right? How do I touch that? And poetry has been the place that's really allowed me to touch those things, to name those things. I don't think it's any surprise that poetry has really, really surfaced for me in the way it has over these past number of years since my mom's passing. She passed away in March of 2013, and poetry has been one of the main ways that I've found myself processing the grief of her passing. And so in that way, it's like, yeah, poetry has been a necessity for me. Because it has brought so much to the surface, in me, for me. It's also invited me to pay attention, not only internally, but externally, to the things happening around me. Because, poetry, it really is one of those things that helps me or invites me into this posture of being observant in the world, to noticing the things around me, even the sort of the small notice things that we might pass over in the course of a day as we rush through our day. I think taking this posture of the poet's posture as I move through the world has been like, how are you noticing those the small things, the in-between spaces, the space between yourself and another person, what's happening there? There's a poet, Elizabeth Alexander, in one of her poems, she says poetry is the dust, is the dust in the corner. It's the thing that gets you from here to there. Like it's the space in between here and there. It's the dust you pass by in the corner. It's been an invitation to notice the small things, which has for me sparked a lot of gratitude to see and to notice and to take delight in those small things. It's especially as I've been just parenting, that's been a joy to be able to notice and capture and, you know, write down some of those small things, those conversations that will spark a whole poem for me. So in that way, there's a lot of poets who will say things along the lines of poetry saved my life, you know, and I think what they, what, when I would, if I would say something like that, it would, you know, mean that it's really invited me into this deeper humanity, this deeper way of being human. You know, one of my all-time favorite quotes is from St. Irenaeus, where he says, "The glory of God is a human being fully alive." And so I think poetry has been this invitation and toward a more fully alive way of being in the world. And as I think about poetry and the way it's aided me in terms of navigating some of the more difficult, you know, passages or texts within scripture, it really, I think, has given me, it's when you recognize, especially some of those poetic texts, some of like the imprecatory Psalms, right? And you realize that, okay, this is poetry. And if I'm reading poetry, it means the first thing that a poem means is that I'm not coming to it to read it literally. Like, I'm coming to it and I'm asking different questions, and I'm getting underneath of the symbolism and the emotion and the, you know, and so there's this invitation to sit with some of those texts in a different way and to be okay with unresolved tension. To be okay with a text giving rise to more questions than it does answers. And to know that what this text might be saying on the page doesn't actually end with the page. Like, there's this continual engagement with it, and this invitation then to come into conversation with God and to wrestle, and to wrestle with how it's meeting me in a particular moment. So I think really it kind of circles back to what we talked about at the beginning of just, it's helped me because it said, it's okay to have questions. It's okay to push back a little bit. You know, it's okay to sit in tension and, you know, let the text do its work in that way. I think part of the work that text does, even the difficult text, is the tension that it gives rise to in us. And it invites us, yes, sit, wrestle with it, wrestle through it, sit with the emotions of it. And, you know, we're not, this isn't all like, don't read this all as a history book. Don't read this all as a, like, in the same way that you might read a novel. There's different genres within the text. How can we approach them and, you know, let them sit with us in the way that they're meant to, in that way? So
I don't think I will forget that phrase, the poet's posture. And I think about, even when I go to the Psalms, I think of times of initially just being utterly perplexed at some of the Psalms around wishing violence and violent mm-hmm. acts against one's enemies and unsure what to do with that. But if in poetry, you're saying there's this posture of observing the little things, there's this kind of pause, there's this pause you take in what's going on. And I remember someone saying, hey, like, you know, these are challenging texts, but like, imagine someone like who had just lost their child to some police brutality and who experiences this kind of mm-hmm. anger and how that will come to expression, and observing these little things, these different perspectives on the text, helped open it up to me in new ways.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's exactly it. I mean, when you put yourself inside of the emotion of that in a way, and you connect, and even to what we're talking about before of just understanding these texts as being written from those who've experienced the underside of history in that way. It's like, I can hear it. I can hear the anger. I don't have to take it as God is telling them to kill the baby. Like, no, like I don't have to receive it that way. Even if someone says, and it's like, God said this, it's like, okay, let's also jump back and recognize how throughout history people have projected on to God their own anger in order to justify violence, right? And the ways that it's like, okay, how do I take all of this into account as I'm coming to the text, as I'm reading these difficult things? So this is, and so poetry has been a help to me because it's been one of those ways that's been just be allow the text to be a spacious place, right? Allow it to be a spacious place.
Drew, I don't know if this will make it in the video or not, but I'll tell you, I have the flu right now, and I'm doing all right. I'm recovering. I was like, okay, I'm feeling okay. But then some of the things you've said have been so touching that I've just been like almost like holding back tears here. So that's just like set me off now, and now I feel like I'm just barely hanging together. But I say that out of as to tell you how much some of the things you've shared have how meaningful they've been. It's interesting to me, right? You chose the title of the first book to carry this title, God Speaks Through Wombs. I noticed that at the end of Touch the Earth, you talk about the earth as a womb that gives birth to the risen Jesus, and then just the dominoes fall and the creation of new life. Can you read this poem for us, and then tell us what does this metaphor, God Speaks Through Wombs, what does it mean to you? And then to our audience and listeners and viewers, just pay close attention to the last lines of this poem. It's really, really powerful.
God speaks through wombs. In the days of empires and puppet regimes, God speaks. Through wombs, wrested and discarded because they were unviable. This is what they do. The Romes, the Babylons, the USAs, the men. Tossed to the side as detritus, what they've deemed unfit to be utilized. But God speaks through wombs, birthing prophetic utterances. The object of public scorn, given the power to name the happenings of the Lord. Elizabeth is her name. Say her name. It is she who will be the one through whom the covenant is kept. She, like a priestess, speaks her word while the leading male voices are shut. Enough of this unbelieving religion that masquerades as faith. Divine favor is placed on what we have disgraced. This poem, yeah, I mean, it really carries the heart of, I think, both projects. And it's the title, God Speaks Through Wombs, is really informed by what I was talking about a little bit earlier in terms of Luke's desire to center the voices of women in the way that he's telling this narrative. His particular interest in the voice of Mary and Elizabeth, in the early, chapters of the Gospel of Luke, the way that he narrates their stories, unlike the other gospel writers, he's carrying this kind of throughout, and it's this sort of metaphor for how God's activity in the world, the way that God is moving and showing up in the world, is like the central place of that is more often than not on the margins and in the midst of those that the ones in power, the ones who see themselves as the center, have pushed to the side, have diminished their voices, throughout history, it's, you know, I say, you know, this is what they do. The Romes, the Babylons, the USAs, the men, right? There's this, those in power who have taken this position, and God's showing up in the world, like even in those original, those first birth narratives, right? God shows up in the world and announces God's activity to the poor shepherds out in the field, right? To, you know, a teenage mother from you know, like in the this backwater town of Nazareth, like all of these things. It's like God is saying something to us if we would listen. And, you know, when Jesus shows up on the scene in Luke 4 and he's like, I've come to preach good news to the poor. It's like, do we hear what Jesus is saying? Do we hear this is not a message that is going to sit well with those in the halls of power, right? It's Mary's Magnificat, right? It's the you know, the mighty one has come to cast down those, you know, who are high on their thrones and lift up the lowly. He has come to send, you know, to fill the hungry with good things and to send the rich away empty. Like, that is good news, but it doesn't sound like good news to those who, for whom the current status quo works. It's set up for them, and it doesn't sit well, but it is good news, because to be pulled down from your throne that has perched you high above everybody else and has caused you to look down on them with disdain and to dehumanize them, that is like your salvation is to be brought low. Your salvation is to be brought low. Your salvation is to come back down to reality, right? And for those who have been being trampled by the world, trampled, you know, over and over again, this good news of being lifted up and filled with good things, that's good news. But there's a reason that good news is more easily and readily accepted by those who have been, you know, who are the poor, right? It's there's a reason for that, and that it's much harder. I mean, there's a reason why Jesus says it is, you know, it is easier for a camel to enter through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. It's like, he's getting it, that he's like, he gets how difficult it is for those who are at the center and those who are powerful to receive this message of the kingdom. And so I think this title of this poem, the title of this first book, is really to capture the heart of that and to say, how about we begin to look and see where God is creating this new life, this new creation? Where are the seeds of that breaking through? Probably where, not where you think, probably not among whom you'd think, but we're being invited into that story. And so, that's really what that title contains.
I want to go right back to the beginning. One of the first things you talked about were, you know, entering poetry because of and having hard time with pat answers, with feeling like things were changing in the landscape of your faith. For those who are watching and, you know, have struggling with a relationship to the Bible, struggling in areas of their faith, do you think there's a lesson from your time and experience with poetry that can be helpful?
You know, it's interesting because since writing these books, I think one of the most common responses I hear to people who have engaged the books have been, I've heard countless times people say to me, my curiosity and love for scripture has been reignited after engaging with the poems. And I find I'm always so fascinated by that. And what people often tell me is that the poems have given them permission to engage the text in a different way. And to, you know, not just kind of settle for this is the way that they've been taught to interpret things or to read things or to look at things, which has led to so much of people's frustration, is that it's been this very kind of narrow, constricted one way of viewing things that then bounces up against all these walls and limitations. And to the point we were talking about before, it's the reading of scripture has not been spacious. There has not been room for questions. There has not been room for curiosity. And so I would say, I think that for people who have struggled with scripture or have frustrations with it for whatever reason, that there is that in my experience and in writing these poems and engaging scripture this way, it really has been the invitation into don't be afraid to bring your questions to all of it. Don't be afraid to push back on things and say, I don't know about that. And then to bring that into whatever your kind of ongoing dialogue with God is. It's been life-giving for me. There's a quote from the Austrian poet Rainer Maria Rilke that I often return to, where I'll paraphrase it here, but he's writing, it's in his book called Letters to a Young Poet, and he's writing correspondence letters with a young poet named Franz Kappus. And this poet has all sorts of questions for Rilke about life and love and what it means to be human and what it means to be a poet and writing and all of these sorts of things. And Rilke says back to him, he says, be patient with everything that is still unresolved in your heart and learn to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms, like books written in a very foreign tongue. You know, you might not be able to answer all of the questions now, but live the questions now, so that maybe some distant day you will live your way into the answer. And so I think really, I think scripture gives us that same invitation to live the questions, to stay with the questions. I think it's one of the reasons why Jesus asks so many questions instead of providing answers, is because that's the place of learning and discipleship. Being a student is to stay with the questions. I think that would be my response to that.
I'll stay then with a question that we have here that has to do with reading the Bible. If the Bible is a mixed bag of the holy and the human, if it can includes also projecting anger onto God,
yeah.
Tell us your thoughts on what the Bible is. Maybe we can go to this question of what for you still, if it does, sets the Bible apart.
Yeah, I would say that there's a sacred and whole, like there's a sacredness to the text, and not so much in my view of it is not so much that it's the sacredness is of it being this sort of dictated word from God that people wrote down and like that's it, like that's why it's sacred, but there's something about the way that it captures the divine human experience, kind of the full gamut of that. The desire, the human desire to know this God, to reach for this God, to search for this God, and to be able to know this God in a very deep, intimate way, to talk to God face to face as a friend does to a friend, like it talks about with Moses in Exodus, right? It's all of that is captured in this text to the wrestlings with God. You know, from the entire story of Israel Israel being one who wrestles with God, one who strives with God, right? And so you get all of that in this text, and it's really just this narrative of this dynamic love relationship between divinity and humanity that is unfolding and continuing to unfold, that we find ourselves a part of, right? So in that sense, this word is living and active, right? It's unfolding. It acts on us, and it invites us into this dynamic story, and says, participate in it. You are already participating in it. Wake up to your participation in it, you know? And so to me, that's what sets the text apart from, you know, any other just text like book I would pick up off the shelf, in that it's really inviting us into the dynamism of that relationship.
I love that, and it makes me think back to what you said earlier about the poet's posture and observing these little things and the surprising ways that God acts. Like, if God really does speak through wombs, then possibly it's in that mixed bag that scripture is that we'll find God speaking.
Thanks for listening to the Theology Lab podcast. You can get more episodes from this podcast by subscribing to it. And find out what's going on live at Theology Lab right now at www.theologylab.org.